Accession number 22624, Reel 2.
Ray Ashton, Reel 2.
Yeah. I know Christmas itself was a bit grim because there was nothing actually laid on for us. Most of the people have been allowed home on leave or given local leave or what have you. And we had, one chap had a bottle of gin, which we had a drink out of mess tins, which had been highly polished with metal polish, so you could imagine the sort of bluebell-flavoured gin is not the best of drinks. that was the highlight of our Christmas, as I remember. But having finished our basic training, we then moved over to the other side of the camp, which was Hutted campsite, and there we went to the machine gun training, 24th Machine Gun Training Centre, and to the Middlesex Lines, because there were, as I said before, four regiments of machine gun regiments, and we all trained there, all surrounding camps. Some actually trained at Blakeham Camp and Satan Camp, which were sort of satellite camps, as I remember, outside Chester. We trained on Vickers extensively, and then we were allocated to either machine gun companies or ACAT companies. Now, I wanted to stay in a machine gun company because my particular chap I'd paired up with was in a machine gun company. But I was good at aircraft recognition. It was a hobby of mine, and I got high marks on this, so without any choice in the matter, I was transferred to the ACAT regiment, which were, ACAT company rather, which were trained on twin Vickers on a mount, which was absolutely hopeless because these things just used to shake and jadder all over the place, and once you open fire, the sights simply shook. So that was hopeless. I don't imagine ever being able to hit anything with them. But while we were there, they were taken away from us, and we were then given 20mm Oerlikons and Espanos, which we sat astride as ACAT guns. They were a different kettle of fish altogether. So we trained on those, but they were subsequently withdrawn. I think it was when they armed our fighters with cannons, and I think the RAF took them away, and they fitted the aircraft up with these Hispanos and the various 20mm cannon that we had. And so then we became a mortar platoon. We were then issued with 4.2 mortars, which were actually made, I believe, from an old, was it a 4.5 ACAT gun? They were manufactured from old ACAT gun barrels, an obsolete gun barrels, and they were, as I say, 4.2. They stood about 6 foot high, these barrels, quite a heavy old thing. They were the Army's heavy mortar. So I landed up in a mortar company. But then we were posted, those of not old enough, some went to their battalions who were old enough. Those of us who were not 18 went to a young soldiers battalion at Hounslow. And there we stayed till we were 18. And then
what type of things were happening to you at Hounslow?
Not a lot, really. Mainly route marches, bags of ball guards. And we did a couple of home guard exercises, which was where I got shot in the mouth by a home guard.
How did that happen?
We were supposed to be in jury paratroops, of course, and we were told we were going to lose this battle, the Home Guard had got to win, you see. And our corporal at the time was a man of the East Surrey Regiment, and an old sweat who had actually done his time in India and various other places. We were in some houses up at Epsom, and these big old houses had these gravel drives in and out gateway with quite big houses, double-fronted houses, as I remember. And we dived through the gate of one of these houses, and I got shot from inside a laurel bush from a distance of about 3 feet by a blank in the corner of the mouth. Now, the blank itself, of course, is there's no bullet in there, but there's a wad in the end which is compressed cardboard, and the little bits of brass and bits and pieces that fly out all over your face. So I had a lump sort of torn out the corner of my mouth, and smashed my teeth up, which was a bit of a sad business, really, because I never really got over the teeth problem after that. And I landed up in the first place under the grandstand of Epsom Downs Racecourse, which was the first aid post of the Home Guard. And there a doctor sort of patched me up. But apparently, so I subsequently heard, the lads were a bit riled up about this, and apparently the corporal, the sergeant, said, "Oh, so you want to play rough, do you?" And they had, when they finished this clearing this road, apparently they had a number of gorse bushes all over the Epsom Downs, and they charged these gorse bushes with Bren carriers, which was totally out of order, really. And apparently Home Guards were scuttling out, running in all directions, and there was a bit of an outcry about it afterwards. But I spent 6 weeks in Epsom County Hospital, Epsom Cottage Hospital, I think it was. My gear was just put in a cupboard, which was covered in blood. It was just a denim suit, webbing equipment, steel helmet, and a rifle. And that was put in a cupboard in the hospital. And when I came out, of course, nobody came to collect me. I made my own way back to Hounslow from Epsom. And I wore this filthy old outfit with dried blood all over it. And that's the way I made my way back to the barracks. Nobody was expecting me when I got there. It was a weekend. If I'd have any sense, I would have gone home. But, a sergeant major met me. Couldn't believe what he saw, I don't think. And anyway, I was issued with some new kit. So that was the end of that little episode. Subsequently then, we were transferred.
Which young soldiers' battalion was there?
This was the 70th Battalion at Hounslow, Middlesex Regiment. And then we went to join our battalion, which was had just been designated the 1st Battalion after the surrender of the 1st Battalion at Hong Kong. And they were the old 2nd 8th TA Battalion of the Middlesex Regiment, and we joined them at a place called Coles Hill near Amersham, where they were fitting out. And I became stick man for the first time in my life. Stick man was an award. If you were the smartest turned out on guard, you got stick man, you see, which meant that you just wore a red sash and you were the sort of company commander's runner or whatever. So it was sort of light duties, really. And what happened was that I arrived there and I'd got an oil bottle stain on my small pack. An oil bottle fitted in the rifle butt, but nobody ever kept them there. They got stolen. So I'd keep mine in a small pack, but it leaked. So I had a bit of an oil stain on my small pack, which is almost impossible to get out. So when we got off the truck, my name being Ashton, was called out from the roll, and the first 13 blokes were on guard, which we thought was a bit rough having just arrived. Anyway, they said they were short-handed, so I was on guard. But while I was making my way up to the hut with the blankets and stuff, I met a chap who's now sergeant. He'd been a corporal and I knew him up at Chester, and I had a little moan about the fact that I'd been put on guard, and he said, "And what?" We said, "We've been up to our eyeballs, we're short-handed, and we've all been doing double guards and one thing and another." So I said, "Well, look at the state of me, I should be, you know, all sorts of trouble." "Oh," he says, "you can borrow my kit if you like." So he says, "So this hut number, you see." So I went to this hut number, and it was a Longlisten hut, and the end that I happened to arrive at, I suppose, was just a single room. Like one door in the end, and it was just a partition door. And there was this wonderful, immaculate-looking kit, highly polished brasses and blank gold kit and rifle, and I just took the lot, you see, and pressed my uniform and cleaned my boots and went on parade. And, of course, the sergeant major's going down the row and he's tearing them off a strip, take this man's name and all this sort of thing, you know. And he got to me, he couldn't believe his eyes, you see. "Pace forward, about 30 seconds, there you are, see, one man can do it, can all do it." So that was it, so I fell out of stick man. But having got down to the company office, the sergeant was waiting for me, and he says, "Whose kit have you got?" So I said, "But yours, you haven't, you know." He says, "You better come and show me where you got it from." So we take this kit, it was the sergeant major's, and inspected the... I got stick man with the sergeant major's kit. The one and only time I ever got stick man. And my poor old mate Len, he's never forgotten it, because he always says that he never even got on main guard. He wasn't considered smart enough. He usually got car park guards and things like this. And so I was stick man for the first time in my life. But it's funny, looking at it, they do make up for things, these little interludes, don't they? You know, you do get your own moments of humour. And from Coles Hill, of course, we were then, I've forgotten what division we were in then, but it was a home counties division. A blue flash with a red diamond in the middle, and I remember. I think I'm thinking like the 61st or the 62nd or something like that. But anyway, we were then transferred up to Yorkshire, where we at Otley, a place called Otley, where we joined the 15th Scottish Division as a machine gun regiment in support of all the only English county regiment in the division. And there we trained on the Yorkshire Moors, really sort of non-stop training, really, where it was quite obvious when it finally turned out we were training for the breakout after Calm, because the land was somewhat similar, rolling countryside, hills, moors, which was rather like France on the other side of the Bocage areas, you know, and that's where we did most of our training. And from there, we were moved down to...
Any memories of the training?
I can remember being sent home on one occasion. Well, we were up there, and we were dug in by the side of a road, a track, really, not a road, going across the moors, where there was full-scale simulated battles going on, tanks and in support of us, and the Red Army and the Blue Army. I can't remember which one we were in. But... you know, it was quite a serious business. You know, they had aircraft and in support, which and attacking aircraft, which dropped bags of, I suppose it was chalk, I presume, on the tanks, and umpires that decreed whether these were hit or whether you weren't hit, and so forth. And I can remember a Churchill tank trying to get through a gap in a field, a stone wall, with a barn on the corner. And I thought he did a marvellous job getting this booming tank through this gap in the first place. But as he swung the tank on the inside, he just clipped the barn and took the corner out of the barn, and the roof sort of dropped a bit, sagged a bit. An irate farmer came out, started to shout and swear at him, and said, "Well, you might as well have driven through the lot. At least I would have got compensation." So he said, "Well, that can soon be arranged." He put it in reverse, backed in at the barn. The back of the barn fell down. Oh, and from there, we've sort of moved on. But I can still see this confrontation going on there between the tank crew, which thought was all rather hilarious, and this farmer bemoaning he's not. I felt sorry for him, really. But, you know, I thought he'd done very well in the first place to even get him through the gap.
How did the Scotch troops welcome you in the 15th?
Oh, we got on fine, really. I mean, I think there was a bit of there was a lot of rivalry initially, and of course, I think the big thing, one of the notable things, they had the Highland Games while we were down in Otley, a place called Poole, which is the next village along. There was a big football sports ground, and they had the Highland Games down there, and of course, the jocks for the most part were quite small blokes, you know, and our chaps. A lot of them were fairly big blokes. I mean, we had, for example, Leslie Compton, who was played right back for Arsenal in England, you know, at that time, cricketer, and a big chap. And we won the toss in the Cavern. The Middlesex Regiment won the toss in the Cavern. We didn't go down very well. It's to be noted that after the war, I was no longer with them then, but after the war they had a Highland Games up in Germany somewhere. And it was notable that they didn't include tossing the caber in the games up there. But that was, you know, I think our chaps had a bit of coaching and training, and went on and sort of picked these cabers up and tossed them about. Anyway, they won. So. Much of the chagrin. And I can remember another. We used to have a jock in a nice chap, Piper in the Gordon Highlands. He was used to come in our little pub, and he'd bring his. First of all, he brought his charter in and he played some pipes, and he brought his pipes in, and we got quite friendly with this guy. And then he let out one day that they used to oil the bag with molasses and various other things, but he mentioned molasses. And so one of our herbets put a cookhouse and got our Lion's Golden Syrup used to turn up in gallon cans. Well, it wasn't a gallon, but there was some in the bottom of this can. And I was elected to get Jock talking at the bar while they unscrewed his pipes and filled the bag with with golden syrup. And then he was requested to give us a tune, but you can imagine going, and he was not best pleased. I mean, these pipes cost hundreds of pounds, and these were presumably the battalion pipes. And but anyway, we made up for it afterwards. I think we supplied him in beer for a week or something. but for the most part, there wasn't any problems. We tended to have our own pubs anyway, you know. But we've subsequently come across the jocks, you know, since after the war. Most recently was last year at St Charles de Percy Cemetery down in Normandy, where a lot of our lads are buried. And as we turned up, a coach drew up alongside from the 227 Brigade of the 15th Scottish Div, and they had a piper. So we combined our services and they played the pipes while we walked round our comrades' graves, you know, which is always.
And after Yorkshire?
After Yorkshire, we went to, I think it was Worthing first of all, or Brighton, no, Brighton first of all. Then down to, from there, moved down to Worthing, and we used to fire off. Well, it was down at Brighton where we were then issued with the new Mark II bomb, which was a streamlined mortar bomb, gave us extra range and one thing or another. But it was a 21-pound bomb, and the conventional style of mortar bomb like you see today, whereas the previous ones were rather like a cylinder with a round nose and a round stern, if you like, with fins. But these were more streamlined and apparently gave extra range. And we fired all the old ones off into the sea off Brighton. Often wonder if the old fishermen still pick up the ones that didn't explode. But they were, I mean, mortar bombs are a very dodgy thing. You know, it takes very little to kick them off. But from Worthing we went down to, we used to go firing up on the downs, and we moved them down from Brighton down to Worthing. That was it. And while we were there, or while we were at Brighton, we helped waterproof. We waterproofed our own vehicles, which I seem to remember took about 6 weeks in all. And then we aided the Guards Armoured Division, who were in Preston Park at the time. Went up there and helped waterproof their vehicles and the tanks and so forth. And I know that one of our Remy blokes, young Paddy, he was an Irish chap. Handy bloke to know, because he'd actually been in the Irish Republican Army, not the RIA, but the Southern Irish Army, rather, and which used German equipment. So, of course, he was au fait with their machine guns and weapons and so forth. They had to seal the turrets on the tanks. They put a ring of plasticine and so forth around the base of the turret of the tanks, which was blown off with a explosive charge when they landed. Very effective too, apparently, because we were told afterwards Germans were taken by surprise. They thought they'd actually hit the tanks, or somebody had hit the tanks when they set off this explosive charge, but of course it was only them releasing their turret, you know, the Travis. But and from there, of course, we moved into the embarkation areas for Normandy. But while we were there, of course, D-Day started, and we were a bit miffed to think we had been left behind. We imagined we were going to be something up the sharp end, but we were actually backup troops. And now I'm lost here. I'm not sure when we actually landed. I think it was D-6 or D-12, but I'm not really sure. And I'm not even sure of the beach, although I think it was Juno, from what I've seen going back there. I believe it would have been Juno. It could have been the extreme end, this, you know, the adjacent end to Juno, of Gold Beach, but I'm not sure.
What was the crossing like?
Crossing was calm. It was a calm crossing, and I slept up one night. We went across a landing ship tank, LST. The vehicle that I drove over there was a 1500 weight, which was not my normal vehicle, but I was allocated this 1500 weight. And, at this time, incidentally, when they disbanded the ACAT company, they had a lot of our chaps from the ACAT company landed up in the jock regiments, and I didn't want to go in the jock regiment. I mean, I'd been in the Middlesex and this one, I wanted to stop in, you see. Some of the blokes were quite keen to wear the kilt, but not me. I wanted to stop in the London regiment. And I saw this sergeant, so I wasn't happy about chances of being transferred. So he said, "We're looking for drivers," he said. "Volunteer to be a driver." So I volunteered to be a driver. Now, drivers, of course, had to drive everything that the unit carried, from motorbikes onwards. So I did this driving course. So I volunteered to be a driver, and I completed this driving training course, one thing or another. After which they told me I was a batman. So I said, "I don't want to be a batman. I volunteered to be a driver." "Well, you volunteered, you're a driver batman." So for my sins, I became a Captain Townend batman. Now, Captain Townend was a nice enough guy. I mean, he was a decent enough bloke, but very quiet, but didn't converse very much. And I had no idea what my duties were. I just used to polish his kit and clean his boots and money, you know. And when we came to embark, I just sort of assumed that he would have the same kit as we did, what he could carry on his back, you see. So I just packed the same kit that we had. And he went off to... I did put his bedroll on a truck. But other than that, he had no washstand or folding bed or anything of that nature. And, of course, he was not best pleased, as you can imagine. So he said, "I don't think you're very happy in this job, Ashton." So I said, "No, sir, I didn't want it in the first place." I said, "I volunteered to be a driver." "Perhaps you'd be happier in a platoon," he said. So I said, "Yes, sir." So I was duly transferred to a platoon, where in due course I became a radio operator.
Which platoon was this?
This was 15 platoon.
In which company?
D Company. D Company was a mortar company. And 15 platoon was the last platoon in the battalion, in fact. And when we had a rest, I think it was about a week's rest, I was sent back to battalion and done a hurried course as a radio op. So I became a driver operator, which suited me fine. I was far happier. Strangely enough, many years later at our first reunion, I met Captain Townend again, and he was shorter than I imagined him, which is strange. He now ran a hotel down in Devon. And I saw him at the bar, and I went up to him, and I said, "Oh, Captain Townend it was." And he looked at me and he said, "I know the face," he said, "but I can't place you." So I said, "Well, if I just said that I left all your kit behind when we went to Norway..." "Oh, actually," he said, "you were a bloody awful batman." Oh, dear. But he's dead now. But, you know, things strange, really, after the war, when all these sort of things come to light again, you know. Yeah. But I bought him a gin and tonic, perhaps it made up for it. But, I went across on a landing ship tank. The landing ship tank was very... a thin-skinned thing, and we were, of course, in an area between the sea and the tank deck. I suppose it was much wider than an ordinary passageway, with fold-down bunks, and access to the deck was up ladders through a round hatch, and there were very few of these. And I looked at this lot and I thought, well, if we get hit, I can't see us getting up those ladders, we'll go down like stones. I wasn't too happy about this, so I went up on deck and I slept on the canvas top of a lorry. Like a little hammock, very comfortable too. And it was a starlit night, and the ship just rolled along slowly, going quite slowly. When the dawn came, it clouded over. But and I saw the enormous murderer ships in columns with destroyers streaking down the outside and aircraft overhead. And absolutely unbelievable sight. And we'd embarked on landing craft and one thing another, doing our drills and practices, and just embarked and disembarked, didn't go anywhere on them, you know. It was just a practice of loading and unloading, really. But to actually get out there and sort of see what's involved. But while we were at Coles Hill, we got a change of colonel. Our old colonel, who's known throughout the regiment as Fanny Warden, very wealthy man, a smashing guy, and he was... He really thought the world of his battalion, and he left us at Amersham, and he rolled in. He had these big barrels of beer rolled in for the lads, and he hoped we'd all do our best. And said, our nickname, incidentally, is the Diehards. You see, so he said, "Trust you all live up to the motto and die hard," by which we said we hope to, sir, not with the same connotations as he had in mind, of course, but. You know, we talked a lot of Fanny Wolf. Very fair man, very strict, but very fair. and you always felt you got a square deal with him, whatever, whether it went your way or not. But he was replaced by Colonel Hall, much younger man. And when we actually arrived on the beach, there's Fanny Walden on the beach, been a beach master there since up past seven on D-Day. And he said to our Tom Emerson, who was our sergeant, "I thought you'd bloody lot be over and it was nearly all over," he said. But by no means nearly all over, of course. But there were still shells falling about on odd intervals in the water from fair way inland, I would imagine. And then we moved up through a gap in the beach. Still a lot of chaos, a lot of wrecked barges, a lot of knocked out equipment, armoured bulldozers shoving stuff out of the way and so forth. And we went through a gap, minefields either side, and I remember seeing a crashed ME-109 laying in the middle of this minefield, which had obviously been shot down by the defences. And we moved into a place, now there's a name of it, I can't remember the name of it offhand. I should think of it in a minute, I expect. And there we leaguered up in a field, round the outskirts of this field, prior to going into action. Before we actually got there, they stopped the convoy and wheedled out one or two of the machine gun lads with their carriers. There was a wood laying off the side of the road where there'd been snipers, and they reckon there were still a couple of snipers in this wood. They'll take me odd pots. Although, of course, they'd actually bypassed this wood some days before. So they laid into this wood with machine guns, and they subsequently found two, one of which was a woman, possibly a girlfriend of one of the German soldiers left behind or something. But and that was a little copse, not too many miles, 2 or 3 miles inland from the beaches, I would think. And we went and leaguered in this wood, only to find that, of course, just behind us was a gun line of 25-pounders, which let fly at odd intervals in the night. And then the following morning, we departed for what was to be, it wasn't the first battle by any means, but it was the first time that we were in action, which was quite a desultory thing. I think we fired a few rounds, one here and another. And then the Operation Epsom, which was the first big push of the 15th Scottish, went through, and they'd actually very successful. We got bottled up in a town, in a small town, small village, I suppose it was. What was the name of it? I forget now. But the whole blooming advance got bottled up with this. It was Jerry had shelled it and blitzed it, set it on fire, and they were all under fire, and it was a bit of a chaos, really. Well, the div commander apparently disengaged the Argylls, and we went off in support of them, who shot off more or less on their own and captured a bridge which hadn't been blown across the River Oden at a place, there were in fact two bridges adjacent to one another, separated by perhaps half a mile. And this is a place called Tourmaville. And this was just a narrow bridge over what is nowadays quite a small river, really. Well, it's not, you know, it's, what would it be? Not more than 30 feet across, I don't suppose. But it's in a very steep valley. And it goes down in a winding road, very steeply down and then sharply up the other side. On the opposite side is Hill 113 and 112, adjacent to one another. And the Argylls captured these bridges and held them against quite a lot of opposition, as it turned out. And we went down and reinforced them with mortars and machine guns. And it was a bit naughty. In fact, Max Hastings actually described that particular time in one of his books as the only time when the actions equaled those of the Somme, but for just 5 days. And we couldn't understand at the time. Subsequently heard that we actually captured Hill 112, and that's as far as we got. Our actual objective was a little village called Ebrissy, which we never really reached. And they actually captured Hill 112, but were then asked to pull back So we pulled back to the crest just above the River Oden. And it turned out that they had received a warning on the Enigma. I think it was two armoured panzer divisions had been withdrawn from the Russian front. And that has only been known quite recently as a release from the Enigma information. And that was why they were frightened of this finger that the 15th Scottish had pushed about 5 or 6 kilometres into the German lines, and they could see it being pinched off, I think.
What did you see on that operation?
Well, first